Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my great pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to this event, Unlocking Patient-Centred Innovation. My name is Matt James. I'm the Director of BioCentre, and I'm delighted to welcome you here on what is a very wet afternoon, but I trust that what happens in this room this afternoon, this lecture theatre this afternoon, is a bit more stimulating and enjoyable than being outside in the cold and the wet. They're the kind of two extremes. A brief word about BioCentre before we get going. BioCentre is a think tank based here in Westminster, or based here in London, specifically within Westminster. And we look at the ethical, social and political implications presented by new technologies. However, unlike perhaps most think tanks, if I can put it like that, we're concerned as much about the conversation and how the questions are framed as we are about finding out the answers. So as our kind of strapline says or suggests, we like to host the conversation in order to try and bring together all articulate perspectives in order to try and establish a rich and meaningful conversation so that different perspectives can be heard, can be shared and can be learned from. This afternoon's event actually builds on an event that we held last year at a similar time, also part of the ESRC's Festival of Social Science, entitled Creating a Culture of Innovation in Healthcare. And so what we are looking to do this afternoon is build on that event and build the momentum around this whole conversation about innovation in healthcare. Our belief is that as developments of new technologies accelerate, so does the rate at which policy, whether that's science policy, social policy, technology policy, health policy, must also adapt to this developing and changing world. And that requires more than just reactive policy making. We must ask new questions, we must reframe old ones, and we must consider the future beyond perhaps the normal tendency to think about the next couple of years, but think about more 5-10 year timeframes. Emerging technologies require that long-term thinking. So today's theme is to address this healthcare culture through a social scientific focus by making healthcare culture one of the primary questions that we'll address, and in terms of how healthcare innovation can be approached and the combination of cultural impacts that's fundamental to that innovation process, how patients should be and are needing to be involved in that process, and how policy must be framed and must be formed with that as a key element in its thinking. I'm pleased to say that already MPs that may have liked to have been here this afternoon but can't because of Commons commitments, who are members of the Health Select Committee, are very interested in what we're discussing this afternoon, and we're actively pursuing with them the opportunity of building on this event to hold an invited guest invitation event in Parliament in the next couple of months, where we can engage with parliamentarians on this particular issue as well and be able to share what started here with them and hopefully take that forward in terms of policy making and strategy. There'll also be some printed outcomes from this afternoon's event, as there was from last year. And all told, hopefully, we'll be beginning to build traction in all of this. So it's not just a flash in the pan, one-time event, but there's some kind of long-term strategic thinking that's being put into place on this. A couple of the practical arrangements. You should have on arrival received an information guide like this. That should guide you through the afternoon, although due to various commitments, the schedule may change. But hopefully the schedule is giving you some hope that we know how the afternoon is going to be panning out in some form. There's also speaker profiles and various information about the speakers, about BioCentre, and various links there that you can click on and feature online. Those of you with smartphones and iPads can scan the smart tags and get there effortlessly using technology in all its forms. A couple of thanks. We're obviously very thankful to and grateful to the ESRC, the Economic, Social and Research Council, for giving us a grant to hold this event as part of its Festival of Social Science. There should be publicity around for the rest of the festival, so if you like what you hear this afternoon, do please see what other events are taking place this week and get along. I'm sure there will be a series of very interesting events throughout the nation this particular week on this particular focus. We're also very thankful to UCL's Science, Medicine and Society Network, of which Professor Napier heads up, and he's one of our guest speakers this afternoon, who is kindly sponsoring the drinks reception afterwards, which everyone is invited to. We'll be down in North Cloisters for that. But do please continue to stay on and continue the discussion over a drink. But we're very thankful for the SMS Network's kind sponsorship of that event. The obligatory safety announcements, in the event of a fire, it's down the stairs to the ground floor and out in front of the Wilkins building, but I'm sure in the unlikely event that happens, we'll all follow one another, so we'll get out safely. Toilets are in the lower ground floor, so all a floor down from where you approached on the ground floor, the lower ground floor are where the toilets are located. I'd like to introduce now our chair for this afternoon, Professor Daniel Steenstra. I would say I'm somebody who has a growing interest in the field of innovation, but I know Professor Steenstra has a wealth of expertise and knowledge, and so I'm particularly pleased that he's accepted our invitation to chair this afternoon and to share from his wealth of experience in helping to move the conversation on. So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Professor Daniel Steenstra.
Thank you, Matt. I'm very pleased to be here. This is the second event. Matt and I started this last year, and it's good to see that there's an interest here. I'd like to have a show of hands. How many doctors do we have in the room? How many nurses do we have in the room? How many people from industry? How many academics? And how many patients? That's the point.
We've got the social work.
Okay, so policy people, people involved in policy, how many people in policy? And last but not least, patients. Again, look at this. One medical device here, second medical device here, I've got two implants. We are all patients, this is important to us. I was trying to convince an academic colleague in Cranfield. I'm the visiting professor of medical innovation at Cranfield University. I was trying to convince an academic colleague to turn up at this event. He said, nah. He was going to an event about cognitive communication. I said, that sounds like rubbish. How can you have non-cognitive communication? He didn't pick up on the point. He said, how can you not have patient-centered healthcare innovation? Why do we have to talk about this? Patients are so important. And it's more than just talking, because BioCenter, think tank, we need to move from think tank into action tank. And that's what this is about. Last year was great, 2 hours, talk about it. This time, I think it's going to be a great event as well. But it's the follow-up that's important. How are we going to turn this into action? I need my medical device again to look at some of the notes I made about this. Don't overestimate, you cannot overestimate the complexity of this. This is hugely, hugely complex. This is also hugely, hugely urgent. I'm not sure if you've seen this, I think in February of this year, John Appleby, John is the chief economist of the King's Fund, wrote a report trying to predict the future, and this was 50 years from now, trying to see if the current spending on healthcare would continue, what would happen. And in true economics fashion, there's a whole range of outcomes. The worst scenario is that by 2060, 100% of our GDP is going to be spent on healthcare. That means no HS4, no HS5, no infrastructure, no education, everything is going on healthcare. So something needs to change. A realistic outcome might be double digits, something like 16, 17, 18% of our GDP is going to healthcare, which is where the US is today. And we know the US is not sustainable. Lockdown, all sorts of issues about healthcare. So that's why we need to move from think tank to action tank and do something about it. It's absolutely fantastic that Matt has been able to gather a number of different people from different perspectives, different walks of life. I think we're all patients, but they have different disciplines, different views, different knowledge about patient-centered innovation. So I think we start off with David Napier. I know David is a medical anthropologist. I also know he's got first-hand experience of medical innovation. So again, already there, you have two different views. The same person, and I suggest, David, that you take over. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Daniel. I was listening to him talk about the complexity of the problem, and I was looking at this diagram and realizing it's actually far too easy to get out of here. I can trace that relatively simply, and of course what we're going to talk about today is something really much more complex. Thanks also, Matt. As Matt well knows, I've been involved in a number of research initiatives involving patient-centered innovation, including work with home monitoring of type 1 diabetes, liaising between hospitals and caregivers in neonatal care, maternal child health, patient-centered home delivery systems, which was what Daniel was alluding to, and also seeing how the socially disenfranchised and migrants and the homeless in particular use mobile devices to address their therapeutic needs. I'm happy to talk about each and any of these in the discussion forum, but given my role here today as a medical anthropologist on this panel, what I want to do today is talk against what I normally do, and specifically about some of the new problems posed by the shift to patient-centered innovation, and also about some of the unexpected knock-on effects of patient-centered innovation, which is the complexity that Daniel alluded to. Indeed, what happens to innovation when you unlock patient-centered medicine is, I think, really what I'd like to focus on. In the early 1990s, the American Medical Association condemned the use of emerging computer diagnostic programs, arguing that proper clinical decision-making could not be made in the absence of clinical knowledge and doctor-led clinical practice. Patients could be harmed as much as helped, the association argued, by the indiscriminate use of potentially wrong information. Now, that's a long time ago, and the rest is business history. As medical regulatory agencies fought to control what increasingly appeared to be attempts of patient advocates to empower themselves, software developments quickly moved, as we all know, offshore. India, which had virtually no computers in country in the mid-1980s, rapidly moved to fill in the technology development gap, soon to be followed by a number of other nations less affected by the power of medical regulatory agencies and professional lobbying groups. What was happening, of course, was the birth of patient-centered innovation, which grew dramatically and unexpectedly as diagnostic programs became both publicly accessible and cheap. Now, fast forward to London, to London's North Middlesex Hospital specifically, where the newly designed A&E is divided into one entrance for acute care and trauma and another entrance for basic care. Why is this happening? First, because so many people now come to the A&E for basic care that it has become much more efficient to accept this reality and serve these people through a wholly different care pathway. But second, who are these people? The first thing one notices is that they are people from around the globe who together are in need of translators from some 70 or more languages. But that is a practical problem that the hospital has done its best to address. More problematic, 20% of this group of people who walk into the A&E door on a daily basis have no primary care provider. They by and large self-medicate. They're not, in other words, just part of the 500,000 of London families who do not have English as a first language, or the third of them who do not use English at home. They are a window onto the future of healthcare practice, for they represent the approximately 85% of the world's population who must care for themselves, people who must learn by whatever means how to address their personal well-being, life quality, and health status needs. These are, in other words, people who have to innovate. And what do these self-medicators actually do? As medical anthropologists, we watch this behavior. And what do we find? On the patient side, we find most crucially, perhaps, people who rely on family and friends, on those who share their cultural values for advice. This, by the way, is what accounts for the fact that when people migrate into families and into communities, they actually do as well or better than the population at large, and why people who migrate on their own actually have much higher mortality and morbidity rates than those who migrate in groups and into communities. We find people, that is, who use, for better or worse, whatever home remedies both habit and cultural practice have accustomed them to. And what we learn from watching them is that, in terms of mortality and morbidity, community really matters. In fact, it's critical to health. But increasingly today, we also find, as we find with ourselves, no matter what our socioeconomic or cultural status, people who not only go online for information about signs and symptoms of illness, but who are buying remedies and services online in an almost wholly unregulated market environment. Has patient empowerment become just another word for government hand-washing? Is this a fair question, or isn't it? However, the sense, if it is a true or false comment, or indeed if the question actually is itself fair, we need to get back to looking carefully at those A&E walk-ins at the North Middlesex, for they offer us a razor-sharp view into our own future behaviors. As financial resources dwindle and people do what they must to help themselves, our motivations become subjected to the realities we call capability and opportunity. Indeed, anyone who studies behavior change will tell you that these three factors, capability, opportunity, and motivation, are the key to understanding why behaviors change or remain the same, even when they are demonstrably unhealthy, and even when those who behave in unhealthy ways know this. When you are left to care for yourself, you by definition start to sense your own personal vulnerability. And when you acknowledge your own vulnerability, you may or may not be positioned to do something about it, but you do start to think more about the need to protect and empower yourself. You need to be thinking about not only how your vulnerability puts you at risk, in other words, but also about risking what you must do to ameliorate your vulnerability. Right. What chances do you need, must you take in order to ameliorate that condition? For self-medicators today, and especially those who can't get what they need through government services, this means getting whatever therapy you can afford and from wherever you perceive your needs to be met, even if this means both buying questionable medicines online and suspecting that what may be coming through the post is the product of a global market that is, for all intents and purposes, unregulated. Indeed, some hackers now wager that there is virtually nothing they can't find online, given the time and money. These are medicines, some even experimental therapies, made under unknown conditions and with unknown contents. But they're not only medicines, they're also diagnostic and therapeutic recommendations provided online that are derived not from clinical practices that caregivers must be accountable for, but from whatever you think will work, or indeed from whatever some merchandiser in an unknown country puts together with a hope of advancing one or another business strategy. And I can't tell you how many times we receive emails from people saying, I hear there's this experimental therapy, my father needs X, how can I find out about it? Do you know anybody who's using it? These people at the North Middlesex Care Gateway are, that is, taking risks that we all now increasingly take, but just lots more of them, and taking sometimes quite fatal ones. They do what any of us does. They find out what they can, but they do so under extreme conditions that force much harder decisions than most of us have to make. We need, therefore, to look at them closely, for they may appear only to lack a GP, but in fact they show us how anyone might behave in an environment where shortages force harder personal choices about self-management, i.e. patient-centered innovation. Take those amongst us on a more serious level who need a new organ, and I'm reiterating a discussion that we had with the BioCenter about, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I think. Of the roughly 9,000 people annually awaiting organs in the UK, just over a third actually get them in any year. That's about 3,500 of the 70,000 or so known transplants that take place annually around the globe, says the WHO, and I would underline here known transplants because, of course, we don't know. Of those 5,000 to 6,000 who are not given organs in the UK, 1,000 will die while waiting for the procedure to happen. Organ demand is also largely unknowable, as only part of demand is biological. For some with a failing kidney, for instance, this dialysis is a real choice, feasible if not desirable. But demand is also quite limited, as we know, by biology. In a British West Midlands study published in 2010, for instance, more than 1,500 British Asians awaited kidneys, while that same subpopulation donated just over 100. Under such conditions, many do what? They innovate. They go abroad. But of those who do go abroad, one in three will either die or have their new organ fail, making this cohort an astonishingly four times as likely to die from the procedure than those who simply remained on dialysis. Nevertheless, they seek organs anyway. But the problem for patient-centered innovation is not only one of supply and demand, for countries increasingly use health tourism and service provision as a form of economic development. Where health business sees life as an ongoing process of servicing and profiting from the dying, the question is this: how do we separate helpful health practices from predatory ones? Here we must remind ourselves that healthcare may be bankrupting countries. For providers, on the other hand, it's a darn good business. Which is why American-style privatization, by the way, of healthcare is being promoted in some very poor countries, an odd thing to think about. While the U.S. itself spends on healthcare alone half as much money each year as China spends on everything. It's true, the U.S. annual healthcare bill today is equal to half of the total GDP of a country representing a third of the world's population. Puts it in perspective. In the U.S., paying off medical bills is the single most common cause of personal bankruptcy. Without putting too fine a point on it, what we must ask is, does caring actually mean something under these conditions? Deregulation creates, of course, a prime market for doing good business. Buying and selling organs globally is now well established and very profitable, in part because increased need is met by provision from places that remain either minimally regulated or completely unregulated. Indeed, the best surgical outcomes for transplants result when organs are freshest. Renegade surgeons who have been criminally charged in one country move to another, even showing up at times at international meetings to brag about their better outcomes. Never mind the question of where these organs actually are coming from or what harm patients who innovate their own care pathways cause to themselves and to the care systems in their home countries that literally must pick up the pieces of what they have done to themselves when they return. Stem cells provides a similar example of an unregulated medical boom market that incites the need to innovate, offering the terminally ill a chance to participate in experimental trials in unregulated locations in exchange for life savings, their homes, or whatever they can beg and borrow from families and friends. And what are the moral choices being made? How do we morally justify research investment in therapies that are not only patient-centered but person-specific, costing £500,000 or more on an intervention designed to work only for one person? These conundra arguably completely redefine the meaning of patient-centered. So the problem here is not one of deregulating so we can compete with them. For no matter how far you deregulate, you can never compete with no regulation. And the less we offer to patients through traditional services and service providers, the more the ill will of necessity turn to riskier strategies and novel forms of innovation. What we see at the North Middlesex, to return to my example, is a microcosm of a global process. It's what I call enforced innovation. It is something the United States, my country of origin obviously, was traditionally quite good at. Take a socially diverse population, leave them largely to sink or swim, and you will get lots of creative innovating, but at a very high human cost. And not just to those who are most vulnerable, but to those who serve the vulnerable. For what is happening at the North Middlesex on the doctor's side of things is equally alarming. Here, I paraphrase a doctor who devoted much of his life to caring for the homeless. Years ago, he tells me, his work with the homeless population was largely divided into two principal cohorts. Those who had a primary care provider but could not maintain a home — this group would include those with sociopathic tendencies or, say, the homeless mentally ill — and, on the other hand, those who had no primary care provision, like some irregular migrants who possess no community ties or rights to services, people on the street who walk around with more or less late-stage everything, In other words, a pathologist's dream, a body on which everything grows with abandon. But today, he tells me, it's different. Years ago, people argued that it was unfair to use put services online because the poor would be disadvantaged. But no one accounted either for the ubiquity of information or for the cheapness of that technology. In the midst of the two traditional groups of provision haves on the one hand and provision have-nots on the other, we now have a new one that grows exponentially. As an anthropologist, I see this group daily at the St. Mungo's shelter at the end of my street, where every single homeless person has become the bionic carrier of an information-gathering device. For having a phone is now more important to survival than having a home. So at the North Middlesex, the doctor today looks out not only at his or her computer, but across the desk at an equally bionic being whose habit and medical history are now not only, thank you, extremely complex, but almost wholly unknown. For that 20% who have no provision are just the tip of the iceberg of patient self-management. Who these people are, and what they have medically consumed create, in the absence of a primary care history, just one big and potentially very expensive white slate. Has patient-centered innovation actually, then, reduced the real costs of care here? I doubt it. For now, our North Middlesex clinician discovers that his patient has been on dangerously high doses of steroids purchased online to alleviate migraines caused by sinus inflammation. Were the steroids this person took actually real? Well, in this case, surely we hope not. All we can say for sure is that they were cheap, that if they were potent, the person taking them endangered himself irreparably, and that some caregiver is now faced with the most complex concoction of possibly dangerous drugs, home remedies, and self-styled experimenting. I say it is time to quantify what can be gained by integrating patients not only into the social communities that can reduce their vulnerability, but into the communities of care that can make better decisions, ameliorate human agony, and along the way save some of us significant unexpected expenses. To do this, I would argue, means investing in social relations rather than in short-term technical fixes, in even the ones that I study. That undoubtedly create good business markets, but sometimes also lots of human misery. Patient-centered innovation, I would argue, is now critical, but it is also largely a social issue for which a technical fix is merely a sign of a much deeper need. Thank you.
David, thank you very much. We've decided that what we're going to do is get the speakers to talk, to present, and then at the end get the panel together and the questions and answers. But one question I already have, don't answer now, is fascinating, because we're finding that there's local initiatives desperately trying to find patient-centered innovation, but the local initiatives are all around the world, different cultures and so on. How do we bring all these different cultures together? Because people in India have fantastic solutions. How do we work together and together craft this patient-centered innovation? So that's one question, but we'll keep that for later on. What I forgot to mention, if you go to John Appleby's report, King's Fund, the estimation is that of this rising cost of healthcare, technology is about 50% responsible for that. So technology is a major contributor to the rising cost of healthcare. And as you would say, it's part of the problem. It has to be part of the solution. Dave talked about it.